From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we profile two of the Wisconsinites vying to be the Democratic nominee for governor.
First, a look at state school superintendent Tony Evers. Then a chat with Matt Flynn, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin.
Later, our Beats Me series joins a group preparing for a swimming race in the Milwaukee River.
We picked a part of the Milwaukee River that's very close to Lake Michigan. There's the most mixing with the lake and the river, so that also improves water quality.
Plus a trip through Milwaukee's beer and cheese scene, and cellist Robert Cohen describes the challenges of performing in a summer music festival.
You never know what the feeling is going to be at each festival, because usually the feeling, the ambiance of the festival is created by the character of the director.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The gubernatorial primaries are here. In just a week, voters will be headed to the polls to pick who will be on the ballot this November. This week, Lake Effect and WUWM News are profiling the political contenders vying for your vote.
WUWM's Marty Michelson spoke with each of the candidates and asked them this question. If voters were able to speak with you, what's the key message that you'd like to leave them with?
We'll be airing the conversations in alphabetical order, so our first chat is with State School Superintendent Tony Evers. Marty caught up with him at a candidate forum in Mequon. She starts by asking Evers why he's running for governor.
Well, as state superintendent and being an educator my entire life, I've always felt that what's best for our kids is best for our state democracy-wise, best for our state economic development and our economy. So the bottom line is we have to start with our young people and value that. And I've felt that as state superintendent, I haven't been able to, there's a wall put up there, and the wall is the governor and his work. And so it's my job to make sure that our kids are taken care of in a way that we build a strong Wisconsin.
What are the top three issues facing Wisconsinites, and how do you plan to address them?
Well, first of all, education is a top priority. It's my wheelhouse, and we have to not only increase funding for K-12, but it has to be distributed more fairly. Right now, the system is broken. As a Board of Regents member, I fully realize that the state of Wisconsin's commitment to higher education has faltered. We've gone from about 50% state funded to about 15% in Scott Walker's time. Again, that's something that's not acceptable, and frankly, we're seeing it play out in weird ways across the state where people are doing away with the humanities and things like that. So that's So education is clearly one of them. The other one is natural resources. I'm a trained science person. I have a degree in zoology and chemistry, and I taught science. And our natural resources are at risk in the state, whether it's water issues and mining issues that relate to water, large farms and how that relates to water quality, lead in water. So all the things that we value as a state around our natural resources is at risk, and I plan to create a different Department of Natural Resources that actually values science. And the third thing I talk about, there's many more than three, but the one thing in traveling across the state, we all know this, is our transportation system is horrible. We're rated 49th out of 50 states in the nation when we look at roads and bridges and ports and issues around internet. We can't thrive as a state. We can't thrive educationally. We can't thrive as a business, our business people in the state of Wisconsin. We have to have a more robust transportation system. Scott Walker has essentially drawn a line in the sand that essentially we're going to borrow our way to prosperity. We have to find a better way to fund our roads and bridges and mass transit in the state.
How do you differentiate yourself from the other candidates?
Well, first of all, I'm the only candidate that's won three statewide races. I've been state superintendent now for almost 10 years. Last time I won a race with 70% of the vote in 70 of 72 counties. I've never lost a county up north or central Wisconsin. Last time I won, it was Aki County, and so I'm not surrendering any county in the state of Wisconsin. The other thing that's important to realize, I will be able to start the first day. There's no learning curve here. I've been in state government. I've been part of leading organizations. Right now, I'm head of an agency that's in charge of 860,000 kids and 100,000 adults that work with those kids. That background is important. The third thing is my wife and I and our kids and family have lived all across central Wisconsin in my education journey. And that is important because I have name recognition, and also we have lived in places that where 40% of the votes coming from in this next election. So those kind of things that, you know, if you start to look at the issues that people have, they're around values, and we're really close on various issues. It's who can beat Scott Walker at the end of the day.
In what areas do you think you're vulnerable?
I believe as becoming a governor of the state of Wisconsin, having a campaign based on values instead of personal attributes, I think it's really important. And so I don't think I have a vulnerability. I think I've focused on what people I've seen and heard from value as a state, and that's where we're going. I'm going to have a positive campaign going forward based on those values.
Tony Evers is the state school superintendent and one of the people vying to be Wisconsin's Democratic candidate for governor.
We turn now to our interview with candidate Matt Flynn, an attorney and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Flynn says if he's elected, he'll file a lawsuit to end the state's contract with Foxconn, the Taiwanese electronic giant, which is currently building a new plant in Mount Pleasant.
Marty Michelson spoke with Flynn while he was having coffee at Grand Avenue Mall in downtown Milwaukee. She began by asking him why he's running for governor.
I'm running for governor because, very simply, I don't want our democracy destroyed. Donald Trump in Washington has betrayed us to the Russians for blackmail and bribery. He's essentially a slave to Vladimir Putin. And he's divided our country, wrecked our European and Asian alliances, and he's a clear and present danger to the United States. I think he's committed treason and should be removed from office. And in Madison, Scott Walker has betrayed us to his donors. They're a Republican elite of billionaire out-of-state donors who have poisoned our water, corrupted our government, and are destroying the University of Wisconsin, destroying public education, and I want to put a stop to it.
What are the top three issues facing Wisconsinites, and how do you plan to address them?
Well, there are a number of issues. The thing that I have concentrated on the most that I think is of most immediate importance is stopping Foxconn. Foxconn is a crooked deal with a Chinese company, $4.5 billion we're paying them, taxpayer money to basically pollute Lake Michigan and fill in wetlands, take people's homes away from them under eminent domain, even when they don't want to sell. And it's a crooked deal. I will do everything I can to stop it. I'm the only Democrat who has set out how I am going to start litigation the day I get in office, even though they ran down to stick a shovel in the ground and make it look like they were starting to do some work. I will stop it. The rest all say that it's a terrible thing, but can't be stopped, but it must be stopped. As far as the issues are concerned, the top issue is wages. This state right now, the median wage adjusted for inflation is lower today than it was 10 years ago because Scott Walker's donors, the Koch brothers and others, basically had him put a wet blanket on wages, freeze them, by busting unions, passing Act 10, passing right to work, getting rid of prevailing wage, and freezing the minimum wage. I would undo all of that. I would repeal Act 10 and right to work, put back the prevailing wage, raise the minimum wage. We got to get wages up in this state. And we have to have very decent paying jobs in this state. Right now, there's low unemployment, but that's because a lot of people are working part-time. They're working for minimum wage or low wages, or they've given up looking for work. So I'm going to change all of that. The second issue is education. I'll fully fund the UW system. I will restore statutory tenure. I'll reconfirm the mission statement, and I will restore our system to the greatness it should have. And then on K-12, I'm going to put in a system called Pre-K-14, spend more money for pre-K because a lot of studies show that early intervention is essential for the development and education of a child. And I'm also going to provide for free tuition for the first 2 years of an in-state technical school, two-year college, or the first 2 years of any in-state public university for in-state students. And that will give an incentive to high school students to go on to school and get the education they need. The third thing I will talk about is the environment. They've poisoned our water. Scott Walker and his donors have made us a water colony for corporate polluters and out-of-state polluters. I'm going to stop that. I'm going to restore an independent DNR with an independent chair. I'm going to stop this business of letting industry write the permits. I'm going to have our scientists write the permits. I'm going to stop the deep drill willing, the fracking on mining. I'm going to restore Prove It First so that they have to show that it can be done safely. I'm going to stop the pollution of the Menominee River by the Back 40 mine. I will join the Menominee Indians in opposing that. And I will get rid of Foxconn so that we don't pollute Lake Michigan. They're going to take 7 million gallons a day and restore it in polluted form. I'm not going to permit that.
How do you differentiate yourself from the other candidates?
Well, a number of ways. First of all, I'm the only veteran in this race, in the primary, or in the general for that matter, against Walker. I'm a Navy veteran. Some of the independents are veterans, but they're not campaigning very hard. But in the Democratic primary and on the Republican side, I'm the only veteran. So I've gotten very good response from veterans around the state, and I think I can speak to them in a way that the others can't. And being a veteran taught me a lot. So that is something I'm proud of, but it's also something that's helped me.
In what areas do you think you're vulnerable?
Well, the usual response to that question, you know, I was on the recruiting committee at my firm, is that you ask a applicant, what are your bad points and your vulnerabilities? And they say, I work too hard. I really shouldn't work that hard. So that'll be my response. The truth of the matter is, we're running against thugs. We're running against the party of Putin. The Trump-Walker axis is destroying the country. Putin controls Trump. Trump controls Walker. They will do anything, say anything, spend anything to destroy. So I have no vulnerabilities in an abstract sense, but will they make things up against anyone? Of course, but it takes somebody with the demeanor, ability, and experience when you're fighting against thugs and liars to make that clear to people and win.
Matt Flynn is an attorney, the former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and one of the candidates vying to be the Democratic candidate for governor. Flynn spoke with Marty Michelson.
We'll continue our look at the Democratic gubernatorial hopefuls the rest of this week. To see a full profile of each of the candidates, you can head to WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break, then return with our Beats Me series, which answers a listener question about the Milwaukee River. Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. It's time for our latest installment of Beats Me. The series gives you the chance to ask questions that our beat reporters then tackle.
Our environmental reporter, Susan Benz, kicks off the season with a timely question about the Milwaukee River.
Shorewood resident Sandy Pendleton's question about the Milwaukee River was a two-parter.
Is it true that Olympic gold medal winner Johnny Weissmuller once raced in the Milwaukee River? And how's the quality of the water today in the Milwaukee River compared to what it was like back then?
Pendleton couldn't have asked the quality question at a better time. Cheryl Nend with the Milwaukee Riverkeeper happens to be heading out onto the Milwaukee River in her 17-foot Carolina skiff. All three of Milwaukee's rivers, the Menominee, Kinnickinnick, and Milwaukee, have long histories of pollution from industries that routinely dumped toxic chemicals, as well as from polluted runoff from farm fields and cities. Although the rivers are now much cleaner than decades past, Nunn says much work remains.
The Clean Water Act said that our rivers would be fishable, swimmable, drinkable, and we're still not there yet. But, you know, I think it's important to continue to highlight this resource that we have and that we should be able to just jump in the river in our backyards and cool off when it's 90 degrees.
But on this day, Nen's on a different mission, to oversee a test swim for what's being dubbed the Cream City Classic. It's a 1.5 mile race just upstream from where the river meets Lake Michigan. If the weather cooperates, that means no major runoff generating rainstorms. Nen says this portion of the river meets federal swimmable standards.
We picked a part of the Milwaukee River that's very close to Lake Michigan. There's the most mixing with the lake and the river, so that also improves water quality.
Connor Andrews is waiting at the public pier at Jackson and Erie in the Third Ward, where the official race will kick off. The swim coach and water enthusiast helped plan the race and is about to plunge in for the test swim.
So have you done the swim before?
I have not.
And what inspired you to do it today?
Today, out of all days, it's just good water quality tests, and they showed up fine, and there hasn't been much rain. But overall, I guess I was inspired to do this. With all that's going on with the environment, it's important for me to use my platform as a swim coach and a swimmer to do some good.
Sandy Pendleton, our Milwaukee River question asker, can barely contain his excitement. He brought his swim gear along just in case.
Swim with me?
Sure.
Awesome.
That's all the encouragement he needs.
You take the splash.
Pendleton was in the river.
You know, first impression, the river feels really nice, good temperature, nice clarity.
The two swimmers head upstream. Cheryl then maneuvers the boat to hover between them. She says the river could present challenges for the swimmers.
We have these cross currents. So, I mean, it's certainly not an ocean swim, but it can be pretty challenging, even when the water's flat, because there's a lot of things happening below the surface. So it's just something we need to keep track of, you know.
Kayakers paddle by with looks of amazement on their faces. Swimmer Sandy Pendleton lags behind Connor Andrews in the windswept river.
How are you feeling?
Just fine. There is current though, so that is a little bit of a challenge, but I'm doing just fine.
Okay.
Nothing tastes funky or anything.
I didn't forget the other part of Sandy Pendleton's question.
Is it true that Olympic gold medal winner Johnny Weissmuller once raced in the Milwaukee River?
The answer is yes. The Olympian and Tarzan in movies in the 1930s and 40s did indeed swim here. International Swimming Hall of Fame historian Bruce Weigo says the race took place in the summer of 1922.
Central AAU championships were held in the upper Milwaukee River.
Likely just below the North Avenue Bridge. At the time, it was one of a number of popular spots along the river for boating and swimming. Weigo says until industrialization got the better of waterways, swim competitions were common in rivers, including the Potomac and the Hudson.
And he had set out to break the national record in the 150-yard backstroke. And the record was 158, and he went 214. And the article in the paper said that the conditions just weren't right to break the record. And by missing it by 16 seconds was was quite a bit, so the conditions probably weren't good.
Nearly a century later, Connor Andrews won the unofficial test run swim on the Milwaukee River and is thinking about a strategy when Cream City Classic Day arrives.
It's really safety. That's my top priority for me, myself, and for everybody else. Because again, this is more so for just a good cause than it is a real race. I'm going to enjoy it as a race too, as much as I can.
And even considering looping the course.
As for Sandy Pendleton, he offers organizers suggestions on how to fine-tune the race.
That way, if somebody gets into the race who doesn't really know what they're doing.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Later this week, we'll have more on the Cream City Classic swim in the Milwaukee River. There's still time for you to take the plunge. The sign-up for the Cream City Classic ends on Thursday. You can find out more at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, a look at some unique beer and cheese pairings. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Beer and cheese. Okay, now that we have your attention, we know you have likely enjoyed some delicious Wisconsin cheese with your favorite cold one. But have you ever paired them intentionally in order to bring out the best qualities in each?
Maybe not, but this month's Milwaukee Magazine's Guide to Beer and Cheese has some suggestions about which cheeses and beers best complement one another.
The article's authors, dining critic and senior editor Ann Christensen and executive editor Chris Drossner, joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share their thoughts on combinations worth trying for yourself.
Ann Christensen and Chris Drossner, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
When did the culture of thoughtfully pairing beer and cheese take off here locally?
That's a great question, because I've seen it happen sort of incrementally, probably over the past 8 years. I was thinking about this, and maybe we talked about it, Chris, at one point. There was a time when I only wrote about or saw wine dinners. I never saw beer dinners. There weren't a lot of beer festivals. I mean, you weren't even thinking beyond, I don't think, you know, sort of the major label beers as much here, and certainly not how to pair them with food, you know, and specifically certain types of food and like what those flavor nuances would be. I think it's really, really recent within, I would say, you know, certainly within the last 8.
What's your experience with it, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two cultures around artisan beer and artisan cheese have kind of advanced roughly in the same time frame. And I think 2010 is when beer really started kind of its second big explosion that we're still kind of seeing now. And it's not just the number of breweries and that sort of thing, but the number of the different types of beers that are being made and really put out into the market more widely. It's exposing people to new flavors, and it's giving us kind of a broader palette of flavors to match up with food, dinners, that sort of thing. And cheese is a natural fit for that, too.
Right. Traditionally, whether in restaurants, you have lots of wine and cheese pairings or wine and food. More recently, I have noticed more cheese boards being offered like at breweries who only serve appetizers or things like that. Mm-hmm. And you guys have an example of 4 beer and cheese pairings, but I imagine it took a lot more than trying 4 combinations to narrow down what works and what doesn't work. So what was your process to do this?
We started with a wide range of both. Ann picked her favorite Wisconsin cheeses, and I did a whole bunch of Wisconsin beers. And we tried to do a real representative style-wise, you know, range of different styles of cheeses and beers. And I think we kind of intentionally were selecting beers that might go well with certain cheeses or just generally, you know, pairings. And then we kind of winnowed it down to our top 10 or was it no?
It was definitely a process. But I think, I mean, you know, Chris is right. It was a whittling down process that took some time. We wanted to represent different styles and texture. Like if I had to think about cheese, we wanted softer cheese. We wanted a really hard cheese. We wanted a cheese that was much of a more assertive flavored one. And we wanted to find a beer that paired really well with a really mild, creamy cheese. And, you know, there's so many different styles of beer. So Chris was thinking along those lines as well, kind of when he was thinking about beers. Then we had to sort of find that meeting ground, you know? So it was a bit of a challenge, but it was fun to sit down and sample things together.
Yeah, that was the really fun part.
That was the really fun part. And it was surprising. There were things that were really surprising to both of us, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like, she knew the cheeses coming in. I knew the beers coming in. So when we were tasting them together and kind of doing our tasting notes, and we went 4 for 4 on pairings that we thought would work out and then did. And then we kind of built our tasting notes from there. But, there were some definite surprises where, you know, you have the cheese by itself and then you have the beer and all of a sudden there's like a shiitake mushroom note that kind of comes out of one of those kind of funkier cheddars that we had.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about, is finding new things that emerge. It's not just that this tastes good and this tastes good and then they taste good together. It's that you have the chemistry of flavor and tasting that creates an entirely new thing.
So with these strictly beer and cheese pairings, for example, one example you give is called the Reversal. The beer is Serendipity, a New Glarus fruit ale, which is definitely sweeter, and it's paired with a softer cheese. So what kind of contrast are you looking for when you pair beer and cheese? Because unlike wine and cheese, which most people are familiar with, I imagine the carbonation of the beer greatly affects what you can pair with it. And that's a whole nother element that doesn't go with a lot of other beverages that we often have with meals.
Yeah, Serendipity is an interesting one because it's sour. It's not super tart, but there's definitely some acidity to it. And like you mentioned, the carbonation is a factor. That was one that was, I think, most noticeable in the Pilsner pairing that we had, which was Door County Brewing Company's Clawhammer Pilsner with, that was the string cheese, right?
Yeah, that was a really interesting pairing to do because it was the saltiness of the cheese, but it was creamy and rich. And those played off the acidity of the beer a lot.
And that
very,
was,
very well.
That yeah, is. That and that. So what we had was kind of that Pilsner is a pretty effervescent style. So you had that kind of bubbliness working with the creaminess of the cheese and, of course, the saltiness and salt. You know, Pilsner is kind of your standard classic American beer. I mean, it's a German style, but it's when you think of American beer, you think of light, yellow, fizzy lager. And that's kind of close to what this is. So the saltiness, you know, pretzels and beer, the saltiness of the cheese kind of emulated that. And man, that was good.
Yeah, that's an excellent, I think, way of describing it, too. But also, that's a perfect illustration of a really solid pairing and bringing out all the right qualities in each one, you know, and both of them sort of complementing each other.
There's a lot of things that the cheeses are doing and a lot of things that the beers are doing. And the more of those things that you can kind of put together and have it be complementary or contrasting, which is you know, the creaminess and the carbonation, that's more of a contrast than, you know, harmony. But it ends up being harmony. It's good.
So when someone goes and first pairs these up, do you recommend having a drink of the beer first or eating the cheese first? Or does it vary with each pairing? Does it matter?
I think both of us were eating the cheese first. I was thinking about our process, how we did this. I remember I was eating the cheese first, for sure.
Yeah.
Because I was really, for me, you know, I wanted the cheese to be at the right temperature, room temperature. But what do you think, Chris?
Most of these cheeses I was having for the first time, so I wanted to get more familiar with the cheese. I don't think there's a wrong answer, though.
No,
you know,
I mean, I don't either.
You know, if you've had the beer before, I would probably start with the cheese, but we weren't really sure going in how that was going to work out. Or, you know, I mean, I consider myself a beer expert. I think Anne probably considers herself a cheese expert. But we're not, like, you know, this was a new process for us. And it was, I think it went really well. And it was definitely a lot of fun kind of unspooling it.
So cheese making has been stepping away from being a traditionally rural tradition. And beer making is increasingly, there's more and more breweries popping up in city spaces. So how is Milwaukee contributing to this in bringing the cheese and beer making process into the same hub?
I think there's a lot more that Chris can probably say on the beer angle, because cheese, I mean, it's hard to find an urban cheese maker. There is one, and we profile Bob Wills in the story.
Clock Shadow Creamery, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. who started Clock Shadow Creamery. And that's really an anomaly. I mean, that is the one place you can go in the city where you can actually see cheese being made, fresh cheeses. If we were in Madison, we would have, I think, access to many more, you know, cheesemakers than we do here. Because I think there's a lot of cheesemakers in the outside of Madison where their distribution, they don't really get to Milwaukee as often as they get, like, to Madison or those areas, you know.
So we may have a good option of going to a store and seeing so many different cheeses, but when it comes to getting fresh cheese.
Yeah. Although, I mean, you know, I think Clock Shadow is an awesome place in that you can go and get their signature cork cheese. That is something that they alone make. They make cheese curds every day. That's really a cool thing that we're able to have that. But, I mean, I would love to see this grow. I mean, I don't see maybe it couldn't, you know, more cheesemakers coming to the city. But, you know, it isn't something that we're seeing as much of as craft breweries.
Well, yeah, Chris, how about you touch upon the growth of the craft breweries here in Milwaukee?
I'm relatively new to Milwaukee. I've lived here since 2014. And in that time, the profile of Milwaukee's craft beer scene has completely turned over. You still have, obviously, Lakefront, Milwaukee Brewing, you know, kind of the old guard, I guess. But there's been so much action. Third Space opened in 2015, Good City. And there were, I think, 6 breweries that opened that year. And once they start, that's one thing. But as they kind of scale up or, you know, push into the take-home market, it's been awesome. I mean, the way that the way that people drink local beer right now, I think, is pretty different than it was 3 years ago. So that's been an exciting thing to see Milwaukee basically finally start punching its weight in terms of craft beer. The Milwaukee scene now much more closely aligns with what the scene looks like in other cities of this size.
One other point I was going to make, though, just about cheesemakers, is it makes sense for the cheesemakers to be close to the farms where they get the milk, right? So where the cows, the sheep, the goats are being milked. And that makes sense that it's going to be in more rural areas. So I think what I think I'm finding more in Milwaukee is better access to some of these cheeses that we weren't getting before. We have great cheese shops here. And one of the shops that we mentioned, the Village Cheese Shop in Wauwatosa, is new, but it's yet another resource for getting these incredible Wisconsin cheeses that I think we're just seeing more varieties come to Milwaukee where they maybe wouldn't have reached us. They would have just gone as far as Madison, and that's about it. But the cheesemakers in the state are rock stars. They are incredible. I love Wisconsin cheese. I love all kinds of cheeses, but I could probably live on Wisconsin cheeses because there's enough variety to them, you know. They're interesting enough. And it's really fascinating once you kind of throw yourself into it and you start really looking and tasting all the different cheeses that are being made here. And then you understand why the state wins awards consistently from year to year.
Right. So on that note of, you know, not only just the options of Wisconsin cheeses, but now Wisconsin beers or even just Milwaukee beers in general. To close out, can you give us your personal favorite pairing or one that stood out the most to you?
Ooh.
Oh, boy. I really enjoyed the Paradox Red from Raised Grain with the Dunbarton Blue, which is a funky aged cheddar, kind of a cheddar blue hybrid, because that's the kind of beer that I like to drink most often, I guess. Is it's really assertive. It's an IPA. It's bold and it's brash. And that cheese is bold and brash and funky and salty. In many ways, it has the volume of all of the things that it does turned up to like 11. And Paradox is kind of the same way. And it worked great.
I agree with you. I love Dunbarton Blue on its own.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go toward, we talked about Serendipity already. To me, that beer on its own is tart, but it is rich and sweet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like a dessert beer to me, but I love that Burrata that we paired it with so much because it's just an incredibly rich, creamy cheese. It just really is so beautifully pure that it works so interestingly with that beer. But yeah, that was a fave for me, for sure.
Well, I look forward to trying some of these combinations that you both recommended, and I want to thank you, Anne and Chris, for coming in to talk about it today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor Anne Christensen is Milwaukee Magazine's dining critic and senior editor. Chris Drosner is the executive editor. They co-wrote this month's cover story, Beer and Cheese, The Ultimate Guide.
We will take one last break, and then our On That Note contributor, Robert Cohen, talks about the Summer Music Festival experience. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Every month, we talk with our contributor, cellist Robert Cohen, about life as a touring classical musician. Cohen was formerly a member of a Milwaukee-based ensemble and spent time here each year, even as he maintained, and still maintains, a household in England and various tours around the world.
This month, we catch Robert at his home in London in between music festival appearances. Summer festivals are a staple in a classical musician's calendar, and Robert says it's always interesting to play at them because often you not only have to learn new music, you have to learn the festival itself.
This summer, this is basically three out of the four festivals I've never been to before. I wonder how it's going to be before I go. Not only the music I've got to play, but you never know what the feeling is going to be at each festival, because usually the feeling, the ambiance of the festival is created by the character of the director. I suppose that's the same as companies, maybe, but certainly in the music festival, the director, the artistic director, creates something which reflects their own way of putting music together and people together. So you kind of get that sense of what it's about once you know the person who is running it. And in this case, I didn't really know any of the people. So the first one, which was in Finland at the Nurmes Festival, which is the first time I've been there, that was really, really nice because that was full of people that I've known, some of them for a very long time, playing music, some of the music which I also know, but it was a great sort of reconvening of people that I really like, and I really like playing music with, including some people that were actually not my students, but I gave them lessons in festivals maybe 20 years ago, even longer. There was a young cellist called Lauri Angervo, a Finnish cellist, who I saw on one festival, I think it's got to be 20 years ago or maybe more. And now he's, you know, a professional musician. He's living his life playing the cello and doing things. And I haven't seen him since then and really been in touch with him. So it was fantastic to reconnect and to play with him. And that was also the case with two other musicians, Miina Pensola and Antti Tikkanen, who are members of the violinists of the Metaphor String Quartet. And I've seen them over the years many, many times and really enjoyed playing with them. And I met them 15 years ago when they were kind of just starting their string quartet. And we played Schubert Quintet together, that great, you know, classic, incredible piece of music with two cellos. So like a string quartet plus me. And I was coaching them in those days. I mean, I was at a course where I was explaining to them, you know, the finer details of the Schubert Quintet. And on this festival, just very recently, we again played the Schubert Quintet. And of course, now you really see how incredibly they've developed and how that's changed and how life has affected them. And that was so exciting, really, to see, I mean, to almost compare it directly with the experience we had 15 years ago.
One of the things I think about festivals, particularly because they happen over the summer, it's almost like summer camp for musicians in some ways. You know, you get to go and find old friends, make new friends, play music, have this fun time. And it lasts a week or maybe two, and then you're done.
I mean, I think these festivals are not like the American ones in the sense that, like, I remember doing Tanglewood when I was 17, and that was 10 weeks long. So that's an entire lifetime at that age. But when, you know, when you do a week, when you're working so intensively with, I mean, in the case in Nurmes, it was with students. I was giving some concerts, performing with the students and coaching them, also concerts with the other professional musicians who were there. You get so involved. And of course, in Finland, you've got these days that go on all night as well. Mm-hmm. So you're having breakfast together, you're having lunch together, you're giving concerts together. You get so emotionally caught up with every moment. And at the end of the week, it's so sad to leave. Everybody's really emotional and you know, tearful and saying, oh, when are we going to do this again? And so it's quite a journey that you go through in just a few days. In this case, I then immediately moved on to the Orford Music in Canada and had a week doing something very different there. And that was giving my lecture series and workshops. And in that particular case, it was none of the students I knew from before. And I was just literally teaching and working. And my lecture series is all about sort of discovering the learning process and kind of personal development in music. And so that's, again, really focused on people and what we all need and how we respond and how we learn. And every day getting deeper and deeper. And the discussions at the end of the week were so fascinating and so stimulating. And I think the kids were really amazed you know, just quite how deeply you need to get into this in order just to play your instrument well. That was a journey. That week was a remarkable journey in itself, a very sort of bonding. I mean, I feel, again, with those young people, incredibly close, and I've had so many messages from them since then. And at the end of the week, again, you feel, wow, I've lived some of my life with these people, and they feel very, very close to you at that point. And it's a wrench. It's literally a wrench to leave. And of course, I did that at the end of the week and then straight on to the next festival in Germany, which was totally different. And that was it's a chamber music festival called Klosterkamp near Düsseldorf. And in that particular case, it was all performing with other musicians who've met from around the world. And it's directed by a very wonderful cellist called Alexander Hultschoff. And in that case, I mean, it was his vision of how musicians should be together in a way and playing music. And he actually put various pieces of music into the program, which I'd never heard and was really surprised that I'd never heard. And he asked me to play certain pieces, which I'd never played. And I think it's fantastic when you get to my point in my life when there are some great pieces to play and you've never done them before. And again, that sort of searching into the music with other musicians, none of whom I'd met before, and that was kind of a really big surprise. All wonderful musicians, all really intent on producing fantastic concerts and living together in that way, you know, literally breakfast, lunch, dinner, concerts, rehearsing. And it was a very special element of that festival, actually, which is unusual, I think, which is that all the rehearsals were open to the public. So they watched our journey of discovery of the music together and how we would work together right from the early process and then finally at the concert. You know, we got to know the audience as well, very well, because of that. You know, they come after the rehearsals and come and talk about, you know, you were talking about this or that, and does that really make a difference? Or this and that. We thought that was such a fantastic change that you made to the music. And we got very involved with them. And that audience comes every year to the festival. So there's this feeling, again, that they're part of something very big.
Do you find, though, that having a situation like that, you're still in some ways performing while you're rehearsing, that you never just get a chance to rehearse, that there's always kind of an awareness that somebody is watching?
You know, that's such a good question, because that's what I've thought. I mean, it's normally when there've been open rehearsals for me, it's usually maybe the last rehearsal before the concert that the public can come to. And at that point, you're sort of pretty close to being ready to perform. So anything that you rehearse is very sensitive. It's like, you know, these last moments, are we going to make these last decisions? Are we going to have an argument about something? How are we going to cope? And they're quite, it feels like quite a sensitive moment for people to be watching. Whereas actually when they come in for the first rehearsal, which I thought, I mean, relates to your question exactly, you think that you're kind of, you've got an audience out there watching you perform, but you're not ready to perform. You still are really trying to find your way to play together, and especially when you've got all these musicians who've come from all different parts of the world to play. So I thought that it would be really uncomfortable and you'd feel kind of torn between whether you felt embarrassed to say things or to be critical in front of an audience, or making lots of mistakes that you'd feel uncomfortable about that. But strangely enough, it didn't turn out that way at all. I think they were just so warm towards us that as we stumbled along and as we kind of had to say things to each other that were very kind of open and honest, and it seemed to be that it was okay to do that. And actually, because they were at all the rehearsals for all the different pieces, we relax so quickly.
Interesting. I would think that it would be, that the temptation would be there to actually perform as opposed to rehearse.
Yeah, but you know what? In the end, I think you realize that because you're so far from ready to perform, that you're just having to lay yourself bare in front of them and say, look, this is what happens, take it or leave it. And you know, sometimes there's nice moments. For instance, I was playing this really beautiful set of three little tiny pieces by a French composer, Nadia Boulanger, that were written, 100 years ago. And it's just cello and piano. And on the cello is the requirement to use a mute. It's a sordino. It's a kind of little device, a wooden thing that you put over the bridge of the cello, and it mutes the sound. It makes it very much quieter and changes the quality. And I did rehearse part of this with this mute on the cello. And then it suddenly occurred to me that, there are different mutes. Sometimes there are mutes made of wood. Sometimes they're metal. Sometimes they're rubber. And they can dramatically alter the kind of sound that the instrument makes. And because the pianist and I were still searching for the kind of meaning and the quality of this music, because neither of us had played it before, we found, it suddenly occurred to me that, one of the things that was worth trying were different mutes in order to see whether that changed the atmosphere of the music, changed the kind of basic quality of the music. So I took out some other mutes, and what I did was kind of talk to the audience and explain, and I think they were really amazed at how different the basic sound is with different mutes. And then we played the music to them with the different mutes, and I almost kind of asked them to say which one they preferred, because, it was a fantastic opportunity to be able to ask the audience. And I think they all agreed, actually, on one particular one. And we thought, okay, that's it. We're going to work with that. We're going to work with that basic sound.
Was it the mute you would have picked?
It wasn't the one that I first really thought about using, in fact. But in this particular piece of music, it just works so well.
So always room to learn things.
Exactly. And just the whole experience. And again, after the concerts, the audience coming back and saying, we watched all your rehearsals and we watched the process and we feel more involved. We really appreciate the music even more deeply than we would have done if we'd just come to the concert. So I think it was a brilliant idea to organize it. And I thank Alexander for, incorporating that into the festival. So that was, again, a new experience for me, and as you say, always wonderful to have new things that you learn.
Absolutely. Particularly the older we get. We always
want
that.
Yes, exactly. And in a couple of days, I'll be leaving for British Isles Music Festival, which is much closer to home. And I've never done that one before either. And that one's very much more student orientated in the sense that I'll be mentoring and teaching cello and chamber music and things like that, and maybe doing some performing with the students. But, I'll have to report back on that totally new experience next time we talk, because undoubtedly it will be really, really different.
One of the things that's great about old experiences, like our conversations, is that we know they're always going to be fun, and we know that no matter what we talk about, it's going to be interesting. And so, Robert, as always, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to next month and chatting with you and hearing about whatever the rest of the summer is bringing for you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Always my pleasure to talk to you.
Cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month for his On That Note segment. He talked with us this month via Skype from London, in between summer festival appearances.
We have time for some music today. Milwaukee musician Joe Richter performed for us in the studio earlier this summer.
He has a show this Thursday at the Back Room at Collectivo, and here he is with his tune, Just to Stay Alive.
Under the sun, on a beautiful day, my feet in the sand, but I can't run away. It should be so pretty, but it should feel so good. Just take me to a place where it's all understood. Where it's all understood. Leaves on the trees, are such a sweet sound. And the birds in the sky flying all around. You could see me smile, but you could feel me lie. In a day to come, it's all an alibi. It's all an alibi. Arizona, pure insanity. I take a look around and nothing's clear to me. I'm drowning in my tears, I'm falling on the shore. My mind's become delusional, Lord. And I'm alone in war. Darkness fills my mind, a long timeline, constantly justifying all the reasons why. And though it's plain to see that this world I'm in, it keeps getting worse.
Milwaukee musician Joe Richter's latest album is called Revival. He'll play Thursday night, August 9th, at the Back Room at Collectivo.
You can find more songs he performed for us and more information at WUWM.com. Our in-studio performance was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.
For a man undignified, for a man that craves to love, just to stay alive. Just to stay alive. Just to stay alive.